logistics. He only had a tiny window of opportunity, since the race couldn't take place during the fall harvest, the winter rainy season, or the blistering heat of summer, when many of the tarahumara migrate toward cooler caves higher in the canyons. Caballo also had to avoid Christmas, Easter week, the Fiesta Guadalupana, and at least a half dozen traditional wedding weekends. Caballo finally figured he could wedge the race in on Sunday, March 5th. Then the real tricky work began. Because he'd barely have enough time to Paul Revere from village to village to announce the race logistics, he had to figure out exactly where and when the tarahumara runners should meet up with us on the hike to the race course. If he miscalculated, it was over. It was already a tremendous long shot that any tarahumara would show up. And if they got to the meeting spot and we were a no-show, they'd be gone. Caballo made his best guess estimates, then set off into the canyons to spread the word, as he messaged me a few weeks later. Ran 30-some miles out to tarahumara country and back today, like the messenger that I am. The message fueled me more than the bag of pinole in my pocket. Was lucky enough to see both Manuel Luna and Felipe Quimare on the same loop, the same day. When I spoke to each of them, I could sense excitement even in the Geronimo-like solemnness that is the face of Manuel. But while things were looking up for Caballo, my end of the operation was maddeningly difficult. Once word hit the grapevine that Jurek might be going toe-to-toe with the tarahumara, other ultra aces suddenly wanted a piece of the action. But there was no telling how many would really show up, and that included the star attraction himself. In true Jurek fashion, Scott had told almost no one what he was up to, so word of his plans only began to spread a little more than a month before the race. He'd even kept me guessing, and I was pretty much his point man. Scott emailed me a few times with travel questions, but as crunch time approached, he dropped off the radar. 2 weeks before race day, I was startled to see a posting on the Runner's World message board from a runner in Texas who'd gotten a jolt of his own that morning when he arrived at the starting line of the Austin Marathon and found himself standing next to America's greatest, and contender for most reclusive, ultra runner. Austin? Last I'd heard, Scott was supposed to be 2,000 miles away at that very moment, crossing Baja with his wife to catch the Chihuahua Pacific train to Creel. And what was the deal with the urban marathon? Why was Scott flying across the country for a junior varsity road race when he was supposed to be fine-tuning for the showdown of a lifetime on trails? He was up to something, no doubt about it. And as usual, whatever strategy he was developing remained locked in his own head. So until the moment I arrived in El Paso, Texas that Saturday, I had no idea if I was leading a platoon or hucking solo. I checked into the Airport Hilton, made arrangements for a ride across the border at 5 the next morning, then doubled back to the airport. I was pretty sure I was wasting my time, but there was a chance I'd be picking up Jen Mookie Shelton and Billy Bonehead Barnett, a pair of 21-year-old hotshots who'd been electrifying the East Coast Ultra Circuit, at least whenever they weren't otherwise occupied surfing, partying, or posting bail for simple assault, Jen, disorderly conduct, Billy, or public indecency, both, for a burst of trailside passion that resulted in an arrest and community service. Jen and Billy had only started running 2 years before, but Billy was already winning some of the toughest 50Ks on the East Coast, while the young and beautiful Jen Shelton, as the ultra-race blogger Joey Anderson called her, had just clocked one of the fastest 100-mile times in the country. If this young lady could swing a tennis racket as well as she runs, Anderson wrote, she would be one of the richest women in sports with all the sponsors she would attract. I'd spoken to Jen once on the phone, and while she and Billy were wildly eager to join the trek into the Copper Canyons, I didn't see any way they'd pull it off. She and the Bonehead had no money, no credit cards, and no time off from school. They were both still in college, and Caballo's race was smack in the middle of midterms, meaning they'd flunk the semester if they skipped out. But 2 days before my flight to El Paso, I suddenly got this frantic email. Wait for us. We can get in by 8:10 p.m. El Paso is Texas, right? After that, silence. On the slim chance that Jen and Billy had actually found the right city and finagled their way onto a flight, I headed over to the airport for a look around. I'd never met them, but their outlaw reputation created a pretty vivid mental image. When I got to baggage claim, I immediately locked in on a couple who looked like teenage runaways hitchhiking to Lollapalooza. "Jen?" I asked. "Right on!" Jen was wearing flip-flops, surf shorts, and a tie-dyed t-shirt. Her summer wheat hair was in braids, giving her the look of a blonder, lesser-known longstocking. She was pretty and petite enough to pass for a figure skater, an image she'd tried in the past to scruff up by shaving her head down to stubble and getting a big black vampire bat tattooed on her right forearm, only discovering later that it was a dead ringer for the Bacardi rum logo. "Whatever," Jen said with a shrug. "Truth in advertising." Billy shared Jen's raw good looks and beach bum wardrobe. He had a tribal tattoo across the back of his neck and thick sideburns that blended into shaggy, sun-streaked hair. With his flowery board shorts and ripped surfer's build, he looked, to Jen at least, like some little yeti who raided your underwear drawer. "I can't believe you guys made it," I said, "but there's been a change of plans. Scott Jurek isn't going to be meeting us in Mexico." "Oh, fuck me," Jen said. "I knew this was too good to be true." "He came here instead." On my way to the airport, I'd spotted two guys jogging across the parking lot. They were too far away for me to see their faces, but their smooth glide strides gave them away. After quick introductions, they'd headed to the bar while I continued to the airport. "Scott's here?" "Yep. I just saw him on the way over. He's back at the hotel bar with Luis Escobar."
"Scott drinks?"
"Looks that way."
"Sweet."
Jen and Billy grabbed their gear, a Nike shopping bag with a chiropractic stick jutting out the top, and a duffel with the tail of a sleeping bag stuck in the zipper, and we began heading across the parking lot.
"So what's Scott like?" Jen asked.
Ultra-running, like rap music, was split by geography. As East Coast playas, Jen and Billy had done most of their racing close to home and hadn't yet crossed paths or swords with many of the West Coast elites. To them, to just about all ultra-runners, actually, Scott was as much of a mythic figure as the Tarahumara. "I only caught a glimpse of him myself," I said. "Pretty tough guy to read, I can tell you that much." Right there, I should have shut my stupid mouth. But who can predict when the trivial will become tragic? How could I have known that a friendly gesture, like giving Caballo my running shoes, would nearly cost him his life? Likewise, I never suspected that the next 10 words out of my mouth would snowball into disaster.
"Maybe," I suggested, "you can get him drunk and loosen him up."
Chapter 21. "Prepare to meet your God," I said as we entered the hotel bar, sucking down a cold one. Scott was on a stool, sipping a fat tire ale. Billy dropped his duffel and stuck out his hand, while Jen hung behind me. She'd barely let Billy get a word in the whole way across the parking lot, but now, in Scott's presence, she was starstruck. At least, I thought she was, till I saw the look in her eye. She wasn't bashful. She was sizing him up. Scott might be hunting the Tarahumara, but he'd better watch who was hunting him.
"Is this all of us?" Scott asked.
I looked around the bar and did a head count. Jen and Billy were ordering beers. Beside them was Eric Orton, an adventure sports coach from Wyoming and longtime student of the Tarahumara, who'd made me his personal disaster reconstruction project. Over the past 9 months, we'd been in weekly contact, sometimes daily, as Eric attempted to transform me from a splintery wreck into an unbreakable ultramarathon man. He was the one guy I'd been sure would turn up, even though he'd be leaving his wife behind with their newborn daughter in the middle of a fierce Wyoming winter. There was no way he'd be sitting at home while I was putting his art to the test. I'd flat out told him he was wrong, and there was no way I could run 50 miles. Now, we'd both see if he was right. Sandwiching Scott were Luis Escobar and his father, Joe Ramirez. Luis was not only an ultra stud who'd won the HURT 100 and raced Badwater, but also one of the top race photographers in the sport. His artistry aided, of course, by the fact that his legs could take him places no other shooters could reach. Just by chance, Luis had recently called Scott to make sure they'd be seeing each other at Coyote Foreplay, a semi-secret, invitation-only free-for-all described as a four-day orgy of idiocy involving severed coyote heads, poisoned snacks, panties in trees, and 120 miles of trails you'll wish you'd missed. Foreplay is held at the end of February every year in the backwoods of Oxnard, California, and it exists to give a small band of ultra runners a chance to whip each other's butts and then glue said butts to toilet seats. Every day, the four players race anywhere from 30 to 50 miles on trails marked by mummified coyote skulls and women's underwear. Every night, they face off with bowling tournaments and talent shows and endless gorilla pranks, like replacing pro bars with frozen cat food and gluing the wrappers back shut. Foreplay was a battle royal for amateurs who loved to run hard and play rough. It wasn't really for pros who had to worry about their racing schedules and sponsorship commitments. Naturally, Scott never missed it. Until 2006, that is. "Sorry, something came up," Scott told Luis. When Luis heard what it was, his heart skipped a beat. No one had ever gotten photos of Tarahumara runners in full flight on their home turf, and for good reason. The Tarahumara run for fun, and having white devils around wasn't any fun. Their races were spontaneous and secretive and absolutely hidden from outside eyes. But if Caballo pulled this thing off, then a few lucky devils would get the chance to cross over to the Tarahumara side. For the first time, they'd all be running people together. Luis's dad, Joe, has the chiseled oak face, gray ponytail, and turquoise rings of a Native American sage, but he's actually a former migrant worker who, in his hard-scrapping 60-plus years, made himself into a California highway patrolman, then a chef, and finally an artist with a flair for the colors and culture of his native Mexico. When Joe heard his kid was heading into the homeland to see their ancestral heroes in action, he set his jaw and insisted he was going too. The hike alone could, quite literally, kill him, but Joe wasn't worried. Even more than the ultra studs around him, this son of the picking fields was a survivor. "How about that barefoot guy?" I asked. "Is he still coming?" A few months before, someone who called himself Barefoot Ted began blitzing Caballo with a torrent of messages. He seemed to be the Bruce Wayne of barefoot running, the wealthy heir of a California amusement park fortune who devoted himself to battling the worst crime ever committed against the human foot, the invention of the running shoe. Barefoot Ted believed we could abolish foot injuries by throwing away our Nikes, and he was willing to prove it on himself. He ran the Los Angeles and Santa Clarita marathons in his bare feet and finished fast enough to qualify for the elite Boston Marathon. He was rumored to train by running barefoot in the San Gabriel Mountains and by pulling his wife and daughter through the streets of Burbank in a rickshaw. Now he was coming to Mexico to commune with the Tarahumara and explore whether the key to their amazing resilience was their nearly bare feet. "He left a message that he'd be getting here later," Luis said. "I guess that's everyone then. Caballo is going to be psyched." "So what's the story with this guy?" Scott asked. I shrugged. "I don't really know much. I only met him once." Scott's eyes narrowed. Billy and Jen turned from the bar and cocked their heads, suddenly more interested in me than the beers they were ordering. The atmosphere of the whole group instantly changed. Seconds ago, everyone was drinking and chatting, but now it was quiet and a little tense. "What?" I asked. "I thought you were really good buddies," Scott said. "Buddies? Not even close," I said. "He's a total mystery. I don't even know where he lives. I don't even know his real name." "So how do you know he's legit?" Joe Ramirez asked. "Shit, he may not even know any Tarahumara." "They know him," I said. "All I can tell you is what I wrote.
He's kind of strange, he's a hell of a runner, and he's been down there for a long time. That's all I found out about him. Everyone sat for a sec and drank that in, myself included. So why were we trusting Caballo? I'd gotten so carried away with training for the race, I'd forgotten that the real challenge was surviving the trip. I had no clue who Caballo really was or where he was leading us. He could be totally demented or merrily inept, and the result would be the same. Out there in the Barrancas, we'd be cooked.
"So," Jen blurted, "what are you guys up for tonight? I promised Billy some big-ass margaritas."
If the rest of the crew had hit a crossroad of doubt, they'd put it behind them. Scott and Luis and Eric and Joe all agreed to pile into the hotel courtesy van with Jen and Billy and head downtown for drinks. Not me, though. We had a lot of hard miles ahead, and I wanted all the rest I could get. Unlike the rest of them, I'd been down there before. I knew what we were heading into. Sometime in the middle of the night, I was jerked awake by shouting nearby. Very nearby, like in my room. Then a bang shook the bathroom.
"Billy, get up!" someone yelled.
"Leave me here. I'm fine."
"You've got to get up!"
I snapped on a light and saw Eric Orton, the adventure sports coach, standing in the doorway.
"The kids," he said, shaking his head. "I don't know, man."
"Is everyone all right?"
"I don't know, man."
I sat up, still groggy, and went to the door of the bathroom. Billy was sprawled in the tub with his eyes closed. Pink vomit was splattered all over his shirt, and the toilet, and the floor. Jen had lost her clothes and found a shiner. She was wearing only shorts and a purple bra, and her left eye was swelling shut. She had Billy by the arm and was trying to haul him to his feet.
"Can you help me lift him?" Jen asked.
"What happened to your eye?"
"What do you mean?"
"Just leave me here!"
Billy was shouting. He cackled like an arch-villain, then passed out cold.
Jesus.
I squatted over him in the tub and looked for non-sticky places to get a grip. I got him under the arms but couldn't find any soft flesh to grab hold of. Billy was so muscular, trying to hoist him was like lifting a side of lean beef. I finally managed to drag him out of the tub and into the sitting room. Eric and I had planned to share a room, but when Jen and Billy showed up with no reservation, or, it seemed, any money for a room, we said they could crash with us. And crash they did. As soon as Eric yanked out the fold-out sofa, Jen dropped like a sack of laundry. I stretched Billy out beside her with his head hanging over the edge. I got a wastebasket under his face just before another pink river gushed out. He was still retching when I hit the lights. Back in the adjoining bedroom, Eric filled me in. They'd gone to a Tex-Mex place, and while everyone else was eating, Jen and Billy had had a drinking contest with fishbowl-sized margaritas. At some point, Billy wandered off in search of a bathroom and never returned. Jen, meanwhile, entertained herself by snatching Scott's cell phone while he was saying goodnight to his wife and shouting, "Help! I'm surrounded by penises!" Luckily, that's when Barefoot Ted turned up. When he got to the hotel and heard that his traveling companions were out drinking, he commandeered the courtesy van and convinced the driver to shuttle him around till he found them. At the first stop, the driver spotted Billy asleep in the parking lot. The driver hauled Billy into the van while Barefoot Ted gathered the others. Whatever Billy was lacking in pep, Jen made up for. During the ride back to the hotel, she did backflips over the seats until the driver slammed on the brakes and threatened to throw her out if she didn't sit the hell down. The driver's jurisdiction, however, only extended as far as the van door. When he pulled up in front of the hotel, Jen burst loose. She ran into the hotel, skidded across the lobby, and crashed into a giant fountain full of water plants, smashing her face against the marble and blackening her eye. She emerged soaking wet, waving fists full of foliage overhead like a Kentucky Derby winner.
"Miss! Miss!"
the appalled desk clerk pleaded, before remembering that pleading doesn't work on drunks and fountains.
"Get her under control," she warned the others, "or you're all out of here."
"Gotcha."
Luis and Barefoot Ted smothered Jen in a tackle, then wrestled her into an elevator. Jen kept wriggling, trying to break free while Scott and Eric were dragging Billy aboard. "Let me go!" The hotel staff could hear Jen wailing as the doors slid shut. "I'll be good, I promise!" "Damn," I said. I checked my watch. "We're going to have to haul their drunk asses out of here in 5 hours." "I'll carry Billy," Eric said. "Jen is all yours." Sometime after 3 a.m., my phone rang. "Mr. McDougal?" "Hmm?" "This is Terry at the front desk. Your little friend could use some help getting upstairs again." "Huh? No, that's not her this time," I said, reaching for the light. "She's right..." I looked around. No Jen. "Okay, be right down." When I got to the lobby, I found Jen in her bra and shorts. She gave me a delighted smile as if to say, "What a coincidence." Beside her was a big old boy with cowboy boots and a rodeo belt buckle. He glanced at Jen's black eye, then at me, then back to her black eye, as he tried to decide whether to kick my ass. Apparently, she'd woken up to use the toilet, but wandered right past the bathroom and ended up out in the hall. After relieving herself next to the soda machines, she heard music and started to explore. A wedding party was going on down the hall. "Hey!" everyone shouted when Jen poked her head in. "Hey-ah!" Jen shouted back, and boogied in to get herself a drink. She butt-grinded with the groom, downed a beer, and fended off the guys who assumed that the wobbling, half-dressed hottie who magically appeared at 3 a.m. was their personal party favor. Jen eventually meandered on, finally winding up in the lobby. "Sweetie, you'd better not drink like that where you're going," the desk clerk called as Jen wobbled toward the elevator. "They'll rape you and leave you for dead." The clerk knew what she was talking about. Our first stop on the way to the canyons was Juarez, a border town so lawless that hundreds of young women Jen's age had been murdered and dumped in the desert over the previous few years. 500 other people were killed in 1 year alone. Any doubts about who ran the show in Juarez were cleared up when dozens of police commanders quit or were killed after drug lords nailed a list of their names on telephone poles. "Kay," Jen said, waving goodbye. "Sorry about the plants." I helped her back into the sofa bed, then double-locked the door to prevent any further escapes. I checked the time. Damn, 3:30. We had to be out the door in 90 minutes, or there was no chance of meeting Caballo. At that moment, he was making his way out of the canyons and up to the town of Creel. From there, he'd guide us down into the Barrancas. 2 days later, we all had to be at a certain spot on a trail in the Batopilas mountain range where the Tarahumara would be watching for us. The big problem was the bus schedule to Creel. If we got a late start tomorrow, there was no telling when we'd arrive. I knew Caballo wouldn't wait. For him, a choice between missing us or standing up the Tarahumara wasn't a choice at all. "Look, you guys are going to have to go ahead," I told Eric when I got back into the bedroom. "Luis's dad speaks Spanish, so he can get you to Creel. I'll follow with those two as soon as they can walk." "How are we going to find Caballo?" "You'll recognize him. He's one of a kind." Eric thought about it. "You sure you don't want me to drill sergeant those two with a bucket of ice water?" "Tempting," I said. "But at this point, I like them better asleep." About an hour later, we heard noises in the bathroom. "Hopeless," I muttered, getting up to see who was puking. Instead, I found Billy sudsing up in the shower and Jen brushing her teeth. "Good morning," Jen said. "What happened to my eye?" Half an hour later, the six of us were back in the hotel van and hissing through the damp morning streets of El Paso, heading toward the Mexican border. We'd have to cross over to Juarez, then hopscotch from bus to bus across the Chihuahua Desert to the edge of the Barrancas. Even with luck on our side, we were facing at least 15 straight hours on creaking Mexican buses before we got to Creel. "The man who gets me a Mountain Dew can have my body," Jen croaked, her eyes closed and face pressed against the cool of the van window. "And Billy's."
If they race the way they party, the Tarahumara don't have a chance, Eric muttered. Where'd you find these two?
Chapter 22. Jen and Billy met in the summer of 2002, after Billy had finished his freshman year at Virginia Commonwealth University and returned home to lifeguard on Virginia Beach. One morning, he arrived at his stand to discover that the luck of the bonehead had struck again. His new partner was a Corona commercial come to life, a beauty who earned top marks in all the bonehead scoring categories. She was a surfer, a secret bookworm, and a hardcore partier whose ancient Mitsubishi had a life-size silhouette of gonzo writer Hunter S. Thompson aiming a .44 Magnum stenciled on the hood. But almost instantly, Jen began to bug him. She fixated on Billy's University of North Carolina baseball cap and wouldn't let up. "Dude," Jen said, "I need that lid." She'd gone to UNC for a year before dropping out and moving to San Francisco to write poetry, so if there was any karmic justice on this beach, then she should be sporting the Tar Heels gear, not some pretty boy surfer like him, who only wore it to keep the pretty boy bangs out of his eyes. "Fine," Billy erupted. "It's yours."
"Sweet."
"If," Billy continued, "you run down the beach bare-ass." Jen scoffed. "Dude, you are so on. Right after work." Billy shook his head. "Nope. Right now." Moments later, hoots and cheers rocked the boardwalk as Jen burst out of a porta potty, her lifeguard suit crumpled on the ground behind her.
"Yeah, baby."
She made it to the next stand a block away, turned around, and came charging back toward the throngs of moms and kids she was supposed to be protecting from, among other things, full frontal nudity by college dropouts going wild. Amazingly, Jen didn't get canned. That came later for shorting out the engine of her lifeguard captain's truck by sticking a live crab under the hood. During quieter moments, Jen and Billy talked big waves and books. Jen revered the beat poets so much, she was planning to study creative writing at the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics if she ever dropped back into college and got a degree first. Then she picked up Lance Armstrong's It's Not About the Bike and fell in love with a new kind of warrior poet. Lance wasn't just some brute on a bike, she realized. He was a philosopher, a latter-day beat, a Dharma bum sailing the asphalt seas in search of inspiration and pure experience. She'd known Armstrong had bounced back from cancer, but she had no idea just how close to the grave he'd actually been. By the time Armstrong had gone under the knife, tumors were spreading throughout his brain, lungs, and testicles. After chemotherapy, he was too weak to walk but had to make an urgent decision. Should he cash in an insurance policy worth $1.5 million, or turn it down and try rebuilding himself into an endurance athlete? Take the payout, and he'd be set for life. Turn it down and relapse, and he's dead meat. He'd have no money, no health insurance, no chance of seeing age 30.
"Fuck surfing," Billy blurted.
Living on the edge wasn't about danger, he realized. It was about curiosity. Audacious curiosity, like the kind Lance had when he was chalked off for good and still decided to see if he could build a wasted body into a world beater. The way Kerouac did, when he set off on the road and then wrote about it in a mad, carefree burst he never thought would see the light of print. Looking at it that way, Jen and Billy could trace a direct line of descent from a beatnik writer to a champion cyclist to a pair of Pabst Blue Ribbon-chugging Virginia Beach lifeguards. They were expected to accomplish nothing, so they could try anything. Audacity beckoned. "You ever heard of the mountain masochist?" Billy asked Jen.
"Nope. Who's he?"
"It's a race, you crackhead. 50 miles in the mountains." Neither of them had ever run a marathon before. They'd been beach kids all their lives, so they'd barely seen mountains, let alone run them. They wouldn't even be able to train properly. The tallest thing around Virginia Beach was a sand dune. 50 mountain miles was way over their heads.
"Dude, that's totally it," Jen said. "I'm in."
They needed some serious help, so Jen looked where she always did when she needed guidance. And as usual, her favorite chain-smoking alcoholics came through in the clutch. First, she and Billy dug into the Dharma bums and began memorizing Jack Kerouac's description of hiking the Cascadia Mountains. Try the meditation of the trail. Just walk along, looking at the trail at your feet, and don't look about. And just fall into a trance as the ground zips by, Kerouac wrote. Trails are like that. You're floating along in a Shakespearean Arden paradise and expect to see nymphs and flute boys. Then suddenly you're struggling in a hot, broiling sun of hell and dust and nettles and poison oak. Just like life. Our whole approach to trail running came from Dharma bums, Billy told me later. As for inspiration, that's where Charles Bukowski stepped up. If you're going to try, go all the way, the original barfly wrote. There is no other feeling like that. You will be alone with the gods, and the nights will flame with fire. You will ride life straight to perfect laughter. It's the only good fight there is. Soon after, surf fishermen noticed weird goings-on each evening as the sun set on the Atlantic. Chants would echo across the dunes. Visions! Omens! Hallucinations! Followed by the appearance of some kind of loping, howling, four-legged man-beast. As it got closer, they could see it was actually two people running shoulder to shoulder. One was a slim young woman with a gay pride bandana on her head and a vampire bat tattooed on her arm, while the other, as best they could make out, seemed to be a welterweight werewolf under a rising moon. Before setting out for their sunset runs, Jen and Billy would snap a tape of Allen Ginsberg reading Howl into their Walkman. When running stopped being as fun as surfing, they had agreed, they'd quit. So to get that same surging glide, that same feeling of being lifted up and swept along, they ran to the rhythm of beat poetry. Miracles! Ecstasies! Gone down the American River! They'd shout, padding along the water's edge. New loves! Mad generation! Down on the rocks of time! At the Old Dominion 100 a few months later, aid station volunteers at the halfway mark heard screams echoing through the woods. Moments later, a girl in pigtails burst from the trees. She flipped up in a handstand, jumped back to her feet, and began shadow boxing. "This all you got, Old Dominion?" she shouted, throwing punches in the air. As the sole member of Jen's support crew, Billy was waiting with her favorite mid-race meal, Mountain Dew and a cheese pizza. Jen stopped bobbing and weaving and tore into a slice. The aid station volunteers stared in disbelief. "Hun," one of them warned her, "you'd better take it easy. Hundreds aren't halfway done till you hit the last 20 miles." "Okay," Jen said. Then she wiped her greasy mouth on her sports bra, burped up some dew, and bounded off. "You've got to get her to slow down," one of the aid station volunteers told Billy. "She's going 3 hours faster than the course record." Tackling 100 miles in the mountains wasn't like running some city marathon. Get in trouble out there in the dark, and you'll be lucky to get back out again. Billy shrugged. After a year of romance with Jen, he'd learned she was capable of absolutely anything except moderation. Even when she wanted to rein herself in, whatever was building inside her, passion, inspiration, aggravation, hilarity, inevitably came firehosing out. After all, this was a woman who joined the UNC rugby team and set a standard considered previously unachievable throughout the sport's 170-year history. Too wild for rugby parties. She'd get so nuts, guys on the men's team would wrestle her down and carry her back to her room, Jesse Pellini, her best friend at UNC, said. Jen always went full speed ahead, only dealing with stone walls after she hit them. This time, the stone wall arrived with a vengeance at the 75-mile mark. It was now 6 in the evening. An entire arc of the sun had passed since Jen had started running at 5 that morning, and she still had a marathon to go. There was no shadow boxing this time as Jen wobbled into the aid station. She stood in front of the food table, stupid with fatigue, too tired to eat and too fuzzy-headed to decide what to do instead. All she knew was if she sat down, she wouldn't get back up.
"Let's go, Mook!"
someone shouted. Billy had just arrived and was pulling off his jacket. Underneath, he had on surf shorts and a Rock Band t-shirt with the sleeves torn off. Some marathoners are thrilled when a friend paces them through the last 2 or 3 miles. Billy was jumping in for the full marathon. Jen felt her spirits rising. The bonehead. What a guy. "You want some more pizza?" Billy asked.
"Ugh, no way."
"All right. Ready?"
"Right on."
The two of them set off down the trail. Jen ran silently, still feeling awful and debating whether to return to the aid station and quit. Billy coaxed her along just by being there. Jen struggled through 1 mile, then another, and something strange began to happen. Her despair was replaced by elation, by the feeling that, damn, how cool it was to be wandering this amazing wilderness under a burning sunset, feeling free and naked and fast, the forest breeze cooling their sweating skin. By 10:30 that night, Jen and Billy had passed every other runner in the woods except one. Jen didn't just finish. She was the second runner overall and the fastest woman to ever run the course, breaking the old record by 3 hours. To this day, her 17 hours and 34-minute record still stands. When the national rankings came out a few months later, Jen discovered she was one of the top 300-mile runners in the United States. Soon, she'd set a world best. Her 14:57 at the Rocky Raccoon 100 was, and remains, the fastest 100 miles on dirt trails ever recorded by any woman, anywhere. That fall, a photo appeared in Ultra Running magazine. It shows Jen finishing a 30-mile race somewhere in the backwoods of Virginia. There's nothing amazing about her performance, third place, or her getup, basic black shorts, basic black sports bra, or even the camera work, dimly lit, crudely cropped. Jen isn't battling a rival to the bitter end or striding across a mountaintop with the steel-jawed majesty of a Nike model or gasping toward glory with a grimace of heartbreaking determination. All she's doing is running. Running. And smiling. But that smile is strangely stirring. You can tell she's having an absolute blast, as if there's nothing on earth she'd rather be doing, and nowhere on earth she'd rather be doing it than here, on this lost trail in the middle of the Appalachian wilderness. Even though she's just run 4 miles farther than a marathon, she looks light-footed and carefree, her eyes twinkling, her ponytail swinging around her head like a shirt in the fist of a triumphant Brazilian soccer player. Her naked delight is unmistakable. It forces a smile to her lips that's so honest and unguarded, you feel she's lost in the grip of artistic inspiration. Maybe she is. Whenever an art form loses its fire, when it gets weakened by intellectual inbreeding and first principles fade into stale tradition, a radical fringe eventually appears to blow it up and rebuild from the rubble. Young gun ultra runners were like lost generation writers in the 20s, beat poets in the 50s, and rock musicians in the 60s. They were poor and ignored and free from all expectations and inhibitions. They were body artists, playing with the palette of human endurance. "So why not marathons?" I asked Jen when I called to interview her about the young guns. "Do you think you could qualify for the Olympic trials?"
"Dude, seriously," she'd said. "The qualifying standard is 2:48. Anyone can make it."
Jen could run a sub-3-hour marathon while wearing a string bikini and chugging a beer at mile 23. And she would, just 5 days after running a 50-mile trail race in the Blue Ridge Mountains. "But then what?" Jen went on. "I hate all this hype about the marathon. Where's the mystery? I know a girl who's training for the trials, and she's got every single workout planned for the next 3 years. She's doing speed work on the track like every other day. I couldn't take it, man. I was supposed to run with her once at 6 in the morning,
and I called her up at 2 a.m. to tell her I was shit-faced on margaritas and probably not going to make it. Jen didn't have a coach or a training program. She didn't even own a watch. She just rolled out of bed every morning, down to Veggie Burger, and ran as far and as fast as she felt like, which usually turned out to be about 20 miles. Then she hopped on the skateboard she'd bought instead of a parking pass and kicked off to class at Old Dominion, where she'd recently dropped back into school and was making straight A's. I never really discussed this with anyone because it sounds pretentious, but I started running ultras to become a better person, Jen told me. I thought if you could run 100 miles, you'd be in this Zen state. You'd be the fucking Buddha, bringing peace and a smile to the world. It didn't work in my case. I'm the same old punk ass as before. But there's always that hope that it will turn you into the person you want to be, a better, more peaceful person. When I'm out on a long run, she continued, the only thing in life that matters is finishing the run. For once, my brain isn't going blah, 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 blah all the time. Everything quiets down, and the only thing going on is pure flow. It's just me and the movement and the motion. That's what I love, just being a barbarian, running through the woods. Listening to Jen was like communing with the ghost of Caballo Blanco. It's weird how much you sound like a guy I met in Mexico, I told her. I'm heading down there in a few weeks for a race he's putting on with the Tarahumara. No way. Scott Jurek may be there too. You are shitting me, the budding Buddha exclaimed. Really? Can me and my friend go? Oh no, shit. We've got midterms that week. I'm going to have to pull a fast one on him. Give me till tomorrow, okay? The next morning, as promised, I got a message from Jen. My mom thinks you're a serial killer who's going to murder us in the desert. Totally worth the risk. So, where do we meet you guys? Chapter 23. We wheezed into Creel well after nightfall, the bus shuddering to a stop with a hiss from the brakes like a sigh of relief. Outside the window, I spotted Caballo's ghostly old straw hat bobbing toward us through the dark. I couldn't believe how smoothly we'd crossed the Chihuahua Desert. Ordinarily, the odds of getting across the border and catching four buses in a row without one of them breaking down or chugging in a half day late were on a par with beating a Tijuana slot machine. On just about any trip through Chihuahua, someone is sure to have to console you with the local motto, "Nothing works out according to plan, but it always works out." But this plan, so far, was turning out to be foolproof, booze-proof, and cartel-proof. Of course, that was before Caballo met Barefoot Ted.
Caballo Blanco! That's you, right?
Before I could make my way off the bus in Creel, I could hear a voice outside booming away like a siege gun.
You're Caballo! That is so cool! You can call me Mono, the monkey. That's me, the monkey. That's my spirit animal.
When I stepped through the door, I found Caballo staring in appalled disbelief at Barefoot Ted. As the rest of us had discovered during the long bus ride, Barefoot Ted talked the way Charlie Parker played the sax. He'd pick up on any cue and cut loose with a truly astonishing torrent of improvisation, seeming to breathe in through his nose while maintaining an endless flow of sound out of his mouth. In our first 30 seconds in Creel, Caballo got blasted with more conversation than he'd heard in a year. I felt a twinge of sympathy, but only a twinge. We'd been listening to the mixed-up files of Barefoot Ted for the past 15 hours. Now it was Caballo's turn. The Tarahumara have been very inspirational for me. The first time I read that the Tarahumara could run a 100-mile race in sandals, that realization was so shocking and subversive, so counterintuitive to what I had assumed was necessary for a human being to go that distance, I remember thinking, what in the hell? How in the hell is this possible? That was the first thing, the first chink in the wall, that maybe modern shoe companies don't have all the answers.
You didn't even have to hear Barefoot Ted to appreciate his cocktail shaker of a mind. Just seeing him was enough. His outfit was a combination of Tibetan warrior monk and skateboard chic. Denim kickboxing pants with a drawstring waist, a skin-tight white tank top, Japanese bathhouse slippers, a brass skeleton amulet dangling to the middle of his chest, and a red bandana knotted around his neck. With his shaved head, cinderblock build, and dark eyes that danced around seeking attention as much as his voice, he looked like Uncle Fester in good fighting trim.
"Yeah, okay, man," Caballo muttered, easing past Ted to greet the rest of us.
We grabbed our backpacks and followed Caballo across Creel's one main street toward lodging he'd arranged on the edge of town. We were all starving and exhausted after the long trip, shivering in the high mesa cold and longing for nothing except a warm bed and a hot bowl of mamá's frijoles. All of us except Ted, that is, who believed the first order of business was continuing the life story he'd begun telling Caballo the second they met. Caballo's teeth were on edge, but he decided not to interrupt. He had some terrible news, and he hadn't figured out yet how to break it without all of us turning around and getting right back on the bus.
"My life is a controlled explosion," Barefoot Ted likes to say.
He lives in Burbank in a small compound that resembles Tom Hanks's Kid Gone Wild apartment in Big. The grounds are full of gumball-colored spider sports cars, carousel horses, Victorian high-wheel bicycles, vintage Jeeps, circus posters, a saltwater swimming pool, and a hot tub patrolled by an endangered California desert tortoise. Instead of a garage, there are two giant circus tents. Wandering in and out of the single-story bungalow are an assortment of dogs and cats, plus a goose, a tame sparrow, 36 homing pigeons, and a handful of odd Asian chickens with claws covered in fur-like feathers.
"I forget that heavy Heidegger word, but it's the one that means I'm an expression of this place," Ted says, although the place isn't his at all. It belongs to his cousin Dan, a self-taught mechanical genius who single-handedly created the world's leading carousel restoration business.
"Dita Von Teese strips on one of our horses," Ted says. "Christina Aguilera brought one on tour with her." While Dan was going through a bad divorce a few years ago, Ted decided that what his cousin needed most was more Ted. So he showed up at Dan's door with his wife, daughter, and menagerie and never left. Dan spends all day fighting with big, cold, mean mechanical things and emerges with grease dripping off his fingers like blood off the talons of a bird of prey, Ted says. "That's why we're indispensable. He'd be a sociopath if he didn't have me around to argue with." Ted made himself useful by setting up a little online store for carousel trinkets, which he ran from a Mac in one of Dan's spare bedrooms. It didn't pay much, but it left Ted a lot of time to train for 50-mile rides on his 6-foot-tall Victorian bike, and to cross-train by hauling his wife and daughter around in a rickshaw. Caballo had gotten totally the wrong impression of Ted's wealth, mostly because Ted's emails tended to be full of schemes better suited to an early Microsoft investor. While the rest of us were pricing economy flights to El Paso, for instance, Ted was asking about landing strips in the Mexican outback for a private bush plane. Not that Ted has a plane. He barely has a car. He sputters around in a 66 VW Beetle in such coughing decline he can't take it more than 25 miles from home. But that's just fine by Ted. In fact, it's all part of the master plan. "That way, I never have to travel very far," he explains. "I'm a pauper by choice, and I find it extremely liberating." During his student days at the Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, Ted had a major crush on a classmate, Jenny Shimizu. While hanging out at her apartment one evening, he met two of Jenny's new friends, Chase Chen, a young artist from China, and Chase's sister, Joan. Neither of the Chen siblings spoke much English, so Ted anointed himself their personal cultural ambassador. The friendship worked out great for everyone. Ted had a captive audience for his symphonic stream of consciousness, the Chens were exposed to a flood of new vocabulary, and Jenny got a little breathing room from Ted's wooing.
Within a few years, three of the foursome would be international names. Joan Chen became a Hollywood star and one of People magazine's 50 Most Beautiful People. Chase became a critically acclaimed portrait painter and the most highly paid Asian artist of his generation. Jenny Shimizu became a model and one of the planet's best-known lesbians, a homo household name, as the Pink Paper declared, for her affairs with Madonna and Angelina Jolie. A career trajectory that, despite the tattoo on Jenny's right biceps of a hot babe straddling a Snap-on tool, Ted never saw coming. As for Ted, well, he did manage to crack the top 30 in the world for breath holding. "I got up to 5 minutes and 15 seconds," Ted says. "Spent the whole summer practicing in the pool." But breath holding, alas, is a fickle mistress, and it wasn't long before Ted was knocked out of the rankings by other competitors even more dedicated to the art of inhaling less than the rest of us. You have to feel a pang of sympathy for the poor guy, burbling away with dreams of glory at the bottom of his cousin's swimming pool, while just about everyone he knew was painting masterpieces, betting superstars, and getting close-ups from Bernardo Bertolucci. And the worst part? Ted holding his breath was actually Ted at his best. In a way, that's even what attracted Lisa, the woman who'd become his wife. They were roommates in the group house, but because Lisa was a bouncer at a heavy metal bar and only got home at 3 a.m., her exposure to Ted was limited to the dry land version of the bottom of the pool. After work, she'd come home to find Ted sitting quietly at the kitchen table, eating rice and beans with his nose buried in French philosophy. His stamina and intelligence were already legendary among his roommates. Ted could paint all morning, skateboard all afternoon, and memorize Japanese verbs all night. He'd fix Lisa a hot plate of beans, and then, with his manic motor finally running down, he'd stop performing and let her talk. Every once in a while, he'd chip in a sensitive insight, then encourage her to go on. Few ever saw this Ted. That was their great loss. And his. But Chase Chen got it. His artist's eye also spotted the quiet intensity in the aftermaths of Hurricane Ted. Chase's specialty, after all, was the dramatic dance between sunlight and shadow. And brother was dramatic dancing ever Ted to a T. What fascinated Chase wasn't action, but anticipation. Not the ballerina's leap, but the instant before takeoff when her strength is coiled and anything is possible. He could see the same thing during Ted's quiet moments, the same simmering power and unlimited possibility. And that's when Chase reached for his sketch pad. For years, Chase would use Ted as a model. Some of his finest works, in fact, are portraits of Ted, Lisa, and their incandescently lovely daughter, Ona. Chase was so entranced by the world as reflected by Ted that he released an entire book with nothing but portraits of Ted and his family. Ted and Ona cooped up in the old Beetle, Ona buried in a book, Lisa glancing over her shoulder at Ona, the living product of her father's sunlight and shadow. By the time Ted was pushing 40, though, his 4 decades of dramatic dancing had gotten him no further than cameos in another man's masterpiece and a spare room in his cousin's bungalow. But just when it seemed he'd crossed that bridge between great potential and squandered talent, something wonderful happened. He got a backache. In 2003, Ted decided to celebrate his 40th birthday with his own endurance event, the anachronistic Ironman. It would be a full Ironman triathlon. 2.4-mile ocean swim, 112-mile bike ride, and 26.2-mile run. Except, for reasons only clear to Ted, all the gear had to date from the 1890s. He was already 2/3 of the way there. He was strong enough to handle the swim in full-length woolies, and he'd become an ace on his high-wheel bike. But the run was murdering him. "Every time I ran for an hour, I had excruciating lower back pain," Ted says. "It was so discouraging. I couldn't even imagine being able to run a marathon." And the worst was yet to come. If he couldn't handle 6 miles in bouncy modern running shoes, then he was in for a world of hurt when he went hardcore Victorian. running shoes have only been around about as long as the space shuttle. Before that, your dad wore flat rubber gym shoes and your granddad was in leather ballet slippers. For millions of years, humans ran without arch support, pronation control, or gel-filled pods under their heels. How the hell they managed, Ted had no idea. But first things first. He was less than 6 months out from his birthday, so priority number one was finding some way, any way, to cover 26 miles on foot. Once he figured that out, he could worry later about transitioning into the cowhide widowmakers. "If I make up my mind, I will find a way," Ted says. So I started doing research. First, he got checked by a chiropractor and an orthopedic surgeon, and both said there was really nothing wrong with him. Running was just an inherently dangerous sport, they told him, and one of the dangers was the way impact shock shoots up your legs and into your spine. But the docs did have some good news. If Ted insisted on running, he could probably be cured with a credit card. Top-of-the-line running shoes and some spongy heel pads, they said, should cushion his legs enough to get him through a marathon. Ted spent a fortune he really didn't have on the most expensive shoes he could find and was crushed to discover that they didn't help. But instead of blaming the docs, he blamed the shoes. He must need even more cushioning than 30 years of Nike air injection R&D had come up with. So he gulped hard and sent $300 to Switzerland for a pair of Kangoo Jumps, the springiest shoes in the world. Kangoos are basically rollerblades as designed by Wile E. Coyote. Instead of wheels, each boot sits atop a full-length steel spring suspension that lets you boing along like you're in a moon bounce. When the box arrived, 6 weeks later, Ted was almost quivering with excitement. He took a few tentative bounces. Fantastic! It was like walking with Mick Jagger's mouth strapped to the bottom of each foot. Oh, this was going to be the answer, Ted thought as he began bouncing down the street. By the time he got to the corner, he was clutching his back and cursing. The sensation I got after an hour in running shoes, I got almost instantly from these Kangoo boots, Ted says. My worldview of what I needed was shattered. Furious and frustrated, he yanked them off his feet. He couldn't wait to shove the stupid Kangoos back in the box and mail them back to Switzerland with instructions for further shoving. He stalked home barefoot, so pissed off and disappointed that it took him nearly the entire walk to notice what was happening. His back didn't hurt. Didn't hurt a bit. Hey, Ted thought. Maybe I can speed walk the marathon in bare feet. Bare feet certainly qualified as 1890s sportswear. So every day, Ted put on his running shoes and walked over to Hanson Dam, an oasis of scrub brush and lakes he calls LA's last wilderness. Once there, he pulled off his shoes and hiked barefoot along the bridle paths. I was totally amazed at how enjoyable it was, he recalled. The shoes would cause so much pain, and as soon as I took them off, it was like my feet were fish jumping back into water after being held captive. Finally, I just left the shoes at home. But why did his back feel better with less cushioning instead of more? He went online in search of answers, and the result was like parting the foliage in a rainforest and discovering a secret tribe of the Amazon. Ted stumbled across an international community of barefoot runners, complete with their own ancient wisdom and tribal nicknames and led by their great bearded sage, Barefoot Ken Bob Saxton. And luckily, this was one tribe that loved to write. Ted pored over years' worth of Barefoot Ken Bob's archives. He discovered that Leonardo da Vinci considered the human foot, with its fantastic weight suspension system comprising one quarter of all the bones in the human body, a masterpiece of engineering and a work of art. He learned about Abibi Bikila, the Ethiopian marathoner who ran barefoot over the cobblestones of Rome to win the 1960 Olympic marathon, and about Charlie Robbins, M.D., a lone voice in the medical wilderness who ran barefoot and argued that marathons won't hurt you, but shoes sure as shooting will. Most of all, Ted was transfixed by Barefoot Ken Bob's Naked Toe Manifesto. It gave Ted chills, the way it seemed directed personally at him. "Many of you may be suffering from chronic running-related injuries," Barefoot Ken Bob begins. "Shoes block pain, not impact. Pain teaches us to run comfortably. From the moment you start